Today, another visit down the rabbit hole with George. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. And my old friend George is back for another exploration down the rabbit hole. Hi George, how are you going?
I'm good, Martin. We haven't spoken for a while, and the last one we did was pretty controversial, but I'm going to try to keep it a little bit more mainstream.
You got me banned.
Yes, I know. I'm worried about that. I don't want to see you lose your channel because you do such a great job. Tonight, we're going to talk about inflation and banking, because it seems to be fundamentally connected. So I thought I would just reiterate what I see, which is something we started off right at the beginning when we met, which is central banks around the world are printing money in unison, so the cross rates are staying very similar.
Well, actually, George, they did. So we had a massive flood of liquidity into the system, right? So it started with the global financial crisis back in 2007-08, but they continued to do it. They did it through COVID, and we had this massive flood of liquidity. It's actually going out now. The tide is going out. This is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, right? So there's a thing called quantitative tightening, which basically means that the central banks are now starting to take money out of the system. And in fact, if you look at the money supply, the M2, money supply is going backwards. So we are in a very different environment from where we were a couple of years ago. But of course, inflation was created by that massive printing of money. And none of the central banks want to admit this, right? So almost most of the Western central banks in particular say, oh, it was all about Ukraine, or it was all about energy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, those were factors. But the fundamental thing that's created this massive inflationary boom that we've got at the moment is that massive money printing. And all of the central banks in the Western economies were dancing the same tune. In Asia, a bit different. Of course, if you look at, for example, Bank of Japan, they actually took interest rates really low, and they're still low. So they haven't sort of turned the wick up on interest rates. And if you look at China, of course, China is at the moment not seeing significant momentum. Their inflation is a little bit lower. But more importantly, their economy is beginning to wilt again. So this is a Western central bank-led inflationary problem. And again, I don't think that many people want to admit that they created the problem in the first place, right? So it's not just all the other factors. It was money printing. You were dead right about that.
Here's an interesting point. Let's look at this money printing situation, because the money goes somewhere when they print it. If we were to take that printing and give it to all the people at the bottom, rather than giving it to all the people at the top, which is where it seems to be flowing, because it's all going into assets and resources, stock markets, etc., where the average person doesn't have access, because most of that is owned by the people at the very top. And if we gave all that money printing just to the people at the bottom, we probably would have inflation, but what we'd have is we'd have incomes staying fairly strong.
Your question is framed correctly. So what happened to all that liquidity? Where did it go? And the bulk of it, through the financial system and through the housing market in particular, bid up assets. And of course, those people who already had lots of assets saw the value of their assets rising, be it stock prices or be it home prices. And so the liquidity runaround flowed to the top few percent of those who already had lots of assets, and they've become richer. And in fact, if you look at the distribution by actual overall value of what people hold, the people at the top have done remarkably well over the last few years, particularly the last 3 or 4 years. So their assets have increased substantially, whereas many other people are actually losing out. So their real incomes are going backwards. Their assets have not done anything like the same. And of course, if you are actually somebody who's wanted to buy a home for the first time, you have to bid up and pay the higher price because those prices were already created by that liquidity flow that we spoke about. So if you want to dance the tune, you've got to play the same game, which means then that a larger proportion of your income goes to pay the banker to be able to get the mortgage to buy the property, to bid property prices up even more. And I will just make one other point. Of course, we've had this massive surge in stock markets in recent weeks. But if you look at it carefully, it's very much anchored in the AI sector of the stock markets. And if you look at the performance of the stock markets excluding the AI element, they've not actually performed anything like as well. In fact, they are probably lower than where they were. So we've got a stock market boom at the moment, which is also exhibiting the same characteristics, in my view, of what we saw through the dot-com bubble in 1999 and 2000. And so, you know, this is an artificial game that we're playing. And the bottom line is that those at the top do well, those at the bottom get crushed and get crushed some more.
I think that's about as clear as I understand it. I think you've summed it up really well. Now, I'll mention something else that you mentioned. You talked about the K-shaped recovery. So I think what we've got is we've got a very strong market with poor people working in that strong market. In other words, because we had the K-shaped recovery, you talked about people that benefited, so the bounce went up, and then you had the people who didn't benefit and they kept sliding down. And I think they're the working class, and certainly seems to be some of the middle class. And as this boom is happening, and now we've got a short a money tightening. So I understand what's now is happening is people don't have a lot of cash. Consumers are finding inflation's kicking in. So they're tightening their belts. That's affecting business, small business. It's not putting money where it needs to be, but it's actually pushing the money straight into the pockets of the people at the top. That's how I see it.
Yeah, give you an example, right? All the banks are now starting to reduce the buffers that they're applying to mortgage lending, right? Because they want to help borrowers, right? When they say help borrowers, what they want to do is to extend the term of your loan so that you pay interest for longer. You know, you can pull out more equity if there's equity in the property, and that will help to pay the mortgage. So what's happening is that more and more the process is, as you say, that the people who are in the moneyed classes are actually enjoying this. You know, they're seeing their shares continuing to support and grow and develop, and you're seeing banks continue to grow their balance sheet because they're actually refinancing mortgages at the expense of ordinary people who in Australia have not seen their real incomes grow for at least 10 years, 11 years, 12 years now. And of course, with interest rates rising very quickly and all of those other things, as you say, a lot of them now are having to hunker down, so they're spending less. Two really interesting observations from recent data. Firstly, that the discretionary versus non-discretionary spending has tilted. So people are spending more on necessities, things they've got to buy, you know, food and what have you, and less on discretionary spending. And that is a really significant change in the weather recently. And that's because they don't have the money anymore. And that also means, of course, that what happens there is that because about 60% of the Australian economy is driven by what consumers do, if consumers hunker down, they actually then will pull the local economy into recession. So there's a recession risk. The second point to make, ABS reported jobs and multiple jobs. And the multiple jobs count has risen again. So there are more people working multiple jobs, particularly part-time jobs, to try and get by. So, you know, the employment story, again, is not really being told fully, I think, by those in power. And it's interesting, the RBA the other day admitted that they would need to see unemployment rise to more than 4% if they want to get inflation under control. So they're all pretty much admitted that the inflation is connected to employment. We've got very low levels of unemployment at the moment, artificially low, but more people are having to work multiple jobs to get by. So, I mean, these are some of the foundational characteristics that is squeezing ordinary people and small businesses, while others, benefit. And the final point, just to add this, the RBA has now admitted that, in fact, companies, big companies in particular, are gouging. So in this inflationary environment that we're in, they're able to put their prices up. And they finally admitted that that's another factor that's leading the inflation number higher. So it's taken them a long time, but they got there in the end.
For a long time, inflation just wouldn't go anywhere. And then we started to see inflation kicking up. Now, interesting, in the stats, when they do inflation figures, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they included property as part of the inflation.
Correct. No, they don't. So there's a rental proxy and there's a new build cost proxy, but there is not actually a mortgage repayment cost inside the way that the inflation numbers calculate. Now, their argument is that if you did that, it would be effectively a feedback loop because effectively interest rates would drive mortgage, which would drive inflation. I think it's a mistake, by the way. I've always believed that you should be looking at the total cost. But of course, they argue that not everybody has a mortgage. You know, in Australia, about a third of people have a mortgage and quite a few people have a small mortgage, but maybe half of those with a mortgage have a really big mortgage and they're the ones that are most exposed. So what they're saying is that it would actually mess up the inflation reporting. But by the way, the inflation stats are pretty much meaningless anyway, in my view, because if you look at it carefully, people with lower incomes, people in rental situations, are paying a lot more relative to their total income. And therefore, their inflation experience is completely different to those in a different environment. Maybe they don't have a mortgage, maybe they own their own property, and they're spending a much smaller proportion of their total income on things. So the inflation measurement, which by the way is fudged and has been fudged for at least 20 to 30 years, in favour, of course, of arguing that inflation is lower. Now, just think that through. If inflation is actually really higher than the official statistics, that means that the RBA should not have taken rates lower a couple of years ago. So they were arguing that inflation wasn't a problem, as you said, and you know everything you know was talking about, why can't we get inflation up? Well, they've now got it up. But the point there is, because you're measuring it wrongly and probably to the downside, it gave central banks much more leeway to cut rates and to drive rates artificially low. And of course, that then had an economically positive impact on the overall economy in the short term in terms of GDP, but it's laid the bear trap that we're now in.
Oh, no, I think I see exactly where this is going. To put it very simply, the way I see an economy running is when you have lots of quantitative easing or lots of money printing, it flows straight into resources, stocks and housing, and also commercial property. Now, what happens then is the prices go up and then the rents go up and then the proprietors then have to start to pay more for their rent, so they then put their prices up on their goods and services that they sell to you and me, like the local coffee shop. That's how I understand it. And it has a direct correlation to us because we need a roof over our heads to live. So everybody thinks that the Reserve Bank is there to keep a growth rate of around 3% annually. That's their ideal figure, which is basically inflation. What happens, of course, is as those prices go up, if people's incomes don't then go up to match, to flow with the increases, which they haven't been, then we've got this situation where incomes are falling behind. People can't afford to pay rents, so they're looking for the cheapest place they can find. So this is happening not just in Australia, this is happening all around the world, in the UK, in the US, in Canada. Now, of course, what people are probably thinking is, well, okay, so we've got all this money printing. Your $20 note used to buy twice as much as it does today, for example. So what's a $20 note? It's a piece of paper with a number on it. And a $100 note is another piece of paper with a hundred on it. So your $20 note versus, but it's still a piece of paper. And we trust that paper. And we believe that that's our currency. And I believe that that's probably what you'd call current. And it changes. And of course, what's it doing? I remember when I used to pay 20 cents for fish and chips, and today I'd be paying more like $15 to $20 for fish and chips. So something happened to those 20 cent pieces. They don't do what they used to do 40, 50 years back. They're not doing that anymore, which means that the currency of Australia and the currencies all around the world have been losing value. Now, this is leading us somewhere. And there's two things I suppose the viewers want to hear. Give me a solution, But also, seeing as we're on down the rabbit hole, what do I see going forward? And I think, which one do you want to tackle first? Shall we fix the problem or shall we talk about the problem?
Fixing the problem requires a different economic structure than the one we've got at the moment, right? And you made the point about the fact that, you know, the liquidity flows flow into the pockets of these few percent who actually control all the levers and basically are calling the shots. And everybody else is effectively a wage slave, likely or not. So, you know, the analogy of a hamster wheel comes to mind. People are running around the hamster wheel, and effectively what they're doing is chasing their own tail to play the game that's being dictated by, you know, the moneyed power. Now, that's the way that things actually work at the moment. And if you continue to play that game, there's no way out, because essentially over time, more and more people get into more and more of those traps and have to run faster and faster and harder and harder. Young people in particular, you know, if you talk to people today, you know, in their 20s, 30s and 40s, they're actually talking about it's really, really tough. Not surprising, because they have to run a lot harder just to stand still. So the question is, how do you change that? Well, the only way you can change it is to think about the economy differently. And the way I think about it is you have to turn it upside down and basically say, no, actually the economy there is to serve and support ordinary people, businesses and households. And the rest of it is there to support it, not to actually milk it. That's a radical alternative, but that's the only way to solve it. Because unless you actually go down that radical route, then there is no way out. Of course, the central bankers will actually blame everybody else. They were partly responsible. And the politicians dance the tunes, of course, and say, oh, it's terrible, isn't it? You know, blame the central bank. But of course, they're part of the problem too. So the way that the political class, the economic class, and the moneyed power all works, it's actually in the favor of the few rather than the many. So you need a different model. Now, I'm not talking communism. I'm talking a different economic model where you invest for the future, where you invest to build an economy that works for individuals and businesses, that you invest in, you know, real small businesses rather than just ever bigger corporates, all of those things. So that's the solution. But then the question is, well, why doesn't that solution work? What, you know, why can't we get there? And that comes to our second question. There's a reason why things are set up the way they are. There is an agenda, like it or not. And sometimes I think people, you know, scratch their head and think, why are things the way they are? Well, maybe it's not just happenstance. Maybe there's a bit more of an agenda running than people want to admit.
If you're wondering what I think is going to happen, as far as our future is concerned moving forward, I think the central banks are going to do a backpedal within 12 months. They'll pump the interest rates up. They'll see the economy starting to fall apart because it's quite weak on Main Street, and they'll have to drop them again. And guess what that's going to do? It's going to push the stock market and the resources and the housing and everything up. And it's pushing the person down the bottom even lower as these rates go. I think if I looked at this on an international scale, as said to you before, central banks all around the world are seem to be doing this together. Isn't that interesting? So there seems to be a plan, and the plan seems to be taking central banking into a more centralized area. In other words, I think we could see central banks being the banks of the country, a bit like our commercial banks in Australia and in the UK. You've got your commercial banks. I think they're going to be done away with. And what's going to happen is the country will be run by its central bank, which will all link up together to a major central bank. We'll call that the Bank of International Settlements, if you like, because that's the biggest one, as I understand, according to John Adams. But where's it going to go? Well, the banks seem to be chasing the idea of digital currency, CBDC, central bank digital currency. And if they control the central bank digital currency, and then they put a social credit score on, and now we're not talking about a banknote anymore. Remember the banknote of a $20 bill? It's an analog piece of paper. I mean, it still it's a fiat currency, but at least you know you can use it and they can't program it. But central bank digital currency, it can be programmed. So you could be tracked. And they might see your show of, you know, the last one we did, I won't say it, and they might say, you know, Martin guy, he was doing all right, but when he ventured into this area, we weren't very happy with him. He's getting a universal basic income, but you know what? Cut it in half this week. He'll get the idea. And of course, there's the other thing too. You're going to get your central bank digital currency. This is where we're going. And it'll be limited to a certain amount. And it'll depend on what you do and behave as to how much you'll get. Also, being programmable, it can be switched off. So if you don't spend all the money in a certain time, then that payment suddenly just disappears. Just picture that for a moment there, Martin. That's what I see. That's a pretty dangerous slope to go down. But at the same time, there are ways we could fix this inflation issue. We could get the economy back on track. And it's funny how when I mentioned the idea of a transaction tax, now, nobody likes tax, but when you mention transaction tax, I mentioned this to our local federal politician. And he said, oh, no, we don't want more taxes. And I said, yeah, you don't want this particular tax. Because if you go down this path, that means all the exchanges done through the stock market, all the exchanges done through the people at the very top are going to actually have to pay tax. Where at the moment, the taxes seem to be pushed onto small businesses and the people at the bottom and the middle class, which we are losing because as they push the money supply higher and higher and higher and their incomes are not keeping up, our middle class is going to disappear into the poorer classes and you'll have people going to work on what would be perceived as very good incomes and they may not even be able to rent because we're just, it's a sinking ship. That's what I see. What do you think, Martin?
Well, there's a few things to unpack there. Firstly, let's talk about central bank digital currency. We know that a number of central banks are in the pilot mode at the moment. You know, Australia is piloting, the US is piloting, others as well. And interestingly, there were a number of people at the sort of World Economic Forum, Bank Inter Settlement, and a few other organizations talking about, well, it's quite convenient to have central bank digital currencies in multiple countries because, you know, you could join them up and you could actually reduce the friction of transactions and all those things. So there is already an architecture that potentially allows central bank digital currencies not just to be in a single country, but cross-country. The second point is that if you look at, for example, the Federal Reserve's recent papers on central bank digital currency, they argue that it will give them a set of extra tools in terms of their monetary policy. Well, that's very convenient, isn't it? I mean, you know, they've done so well with the tools that they've already got so far that they want more tools. So I'm very skeptical of the positive impact of central bank digital currency. And you're dead right, the linkage to credit scores and social scores and those sorts of things can all be there. So effectively, you can be more controlled, made more compliant. And if you break the rules, then you suddenly can't get access to your money. And that is definitely a problem with the central bank digital currency. By the way, it's also a problem with the digital banking we've got today. So if you look at it, even ordinary banks today, retail banks today, can turn your account off at a whim. And I know some people who've been debanked already. And that's why I've been a great believer in arguing for the future of cash and the need for cash to be able to actually work outside the digital system. The second point is that the whole idea of you know, ordinary people working harder and running harder to try and stand still, which is what the doctrine has been for many, many years, for the benefit, of course, of the politicians and also for the you know, the banking class and the money class, is the fundamental rule. Now, obviously, nobody wants to miss a mortgage payment. So guess what? When you've got financial pressure, it's not your mortgage that goes first. It's other things that go first, like you don't get the healthcare that you need, or those sorts of things. So you prioritize paying the mortgage or paying the rent because you have to have somewhere to live. And so what it means is that your value set is determined predominantly by the economic context that you're in, because you know that you need to retain somewhere to live. And of course, we have not built social housing for years and years and years. We haven't built enough housing of the right type. So people are ending up spending more and more of their money on just somewhere to live. And then the final point is, what's life about, I guess, is the question, right? Which is what is underpinning all of this, right? Are we actually just here to feed the machine? You know, be that driven by the central banks or driven by big corporations? Because at the moment, that's the way the economy is set up. We are here to feed the machine. We are the widgets. We are the fodder. And at the moment, we have very little power or influence, which essentially means that we just dance the tune of those dictated to us. Now, that, to my mind, means that we're not particularly free. We talk about democratic freedoms and all those things, but actually, despite that, the game is up pretty much. And so if we are really to think about a different future, you have to start with a different model of the future. But unfortunately, standing in the way are the institutions that actually set things up the way they are and perpetuate the existing. And I think you are dead right. There is a significant risk that the central banks will take rates too high, they'll crush the economy, we'll get a recession. And then, of course, they will drop rates again because it's the tool of choice. And that then creates the more opportunity to create more asset bubbles and all those things. So this whole set of mechanisms, to my mind, is designed with one end in mind. And despite what they say about serving the people, actually, they serve a very small proportion of the people.
Well, I totally agree with that, Martin. That's the way I see it. I think there are plenty of people willing to work hard, but now people are taking on second jobs and third jobs in some cases. Not everybody, but some are. And people are starting to do things like, let's not turn the heating on. And it's freezing in Melbourne at the moment, by the way. So we'll rug up with blankets. That'll save us some money. And now you start thinking, oh, well, like you said, they start to throw things away. The private insurance goes. Then the second car goes. And then where does it end up? But if they do what I suggested, which is that I think that they'll push the rates up, some people won't be able to bear that. They'll have to put their property back on the market to get back what they can. At this stage, when there's a flood of property, I expect the property prices to drop. And then as soon as they drop the interest rates again, well, guess what? They'll go back up. And those people who've gotten out of the market will suddenly find themselves having to come back with a land tax or a stamp duty, we call it in Melbourne. They'll be back on the treadmill trying to get in, and then they may find themselves, well, I can't afford the house I just sold. I'll have to buy one even further out, and they're back into the treadmill. And it's the money system is just being inflated, but there's nothing for the people at the bottom. The middle class are being affected. It's all going to the top. Is there a plan? Now, can we get into a little bit of controversy here? Let's talk about a little bit of conspiracy theory stuff here. What I'm seeing, the WEF, the World Economic Forum, the WHO, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, which is all our governments coming together and in common cause. There's something seems to be happening between all those governments in the United Nations, the WEF and the WHO. WHO wants to create a world health treaty. That would mean the WHO would centrally control health systems around the world in every country. Picture that for a second. That if they say, right, everybody will be vaccinated because it's a WHO initiative, the government simply have to then go ahead and pose that as a law over the citizens, and the citizens have lost their sovereignty. Enter the One World Government, the World Economic Forum. They have a young global leaders group that, so you get your Justin Trudeau, for example. Give you an example of what Justin Trudeau did. A lot of people are very unhappy with him. The farmers were striking. He basically instructed the bankers to close down the farmers' accounts. Suddenly their accounts just were shut. I mean, that's pretty extreme because he saw them as a national security risk. Now that's bordering on almost like a dictator, if you ask me. So all these funny things are happening. Klaus Schwab leads the WEF. You may have heard of Klaus Schwab. So we've got a lot of things happening with banks having more power, corporations having more power, the World Economic Forum having meetings in Davos once a year, talking about where they're going and what they want to do. And having their Young Global Leaders program, like Jacinta Ardern was one of the people that he was working with. We've got Justin Trudeau, presidents of the United States. I think you'd have to look at them. So our leadership, our governments are working in cahoots with World Banking, with WHO, and then we've got our global warming climate change, which they can then use that. Now, I know you believe global warming. I believe in environment. There's a difference. And there's some other conspiracies regarding that, but we won't go down there tonight. As far as weather's concerned, you might want to check this out yourself. But once you get that amount of power starting, you notice it's all starting to centralise. It's starting to become much more controlled by a central point where governments are now starting to take instructions. We have banking also involved. The plan of the WEF is you will own nothing and you will be happy. Now, that's an easy thing to do if you have enough power and you control governments and you control banking, because you can simply keep increasing the money supply, and there's no way the average person, even the middle class, will be able to keep up. It's impossible. This is what we're facing. Now, in politics, we've got this left-right paradigm, you know, the Labor Party versus the Liberal Party. And we've also got this idea of divide and conquer. You would have heard of divide and conquer, surely, Martin.
Yeah, so the idea is, of course, that, you know, if you get people facing in different directions and, you know, worrying about other things, then distracted from the real agenda, right? And that's the question. So is there a real agenda, and is it, you know, a set of distractions? There is, of course, one observation. The World Economic Forum, United Nations, et cetera, none of those are elected, right? So all of them actually are created effectively with technocrats in the driving seat. And my view is that basically they have the arrogance to think they know all the answers and effectively they know what's best for us, right? And your point about the fact that they issue edicts and those edicts then come down to local governments, right? That's exactly what happens. So if you take the central bank digital currency, right? So, you know, that's come down and is now being implemented locally, right? And the point there is that those entities, the technocrats, are not elected. And interestingly, a lot of local governments just say, well, if the World Economic Forum says jump, we should jump. And then linking back around to your, you know, young leaders who, guess what, are being influenced by the World Economic Forum, et cetera, they just say, well, that's what they say, so it must be right. So there is a set of mechanics going on, which means that the technocrats can effectively dictate, determine, control the future of, well, most nations, not all nations, some check out and don't want to have anything to do with it, but certainly Western economies in particular. Now, I think that some of the issues they raise are probably okay and very significant and important, but the overall agenda, the whole idea of top-down dictational control, you know, do this, jump that, whatever, whatever, is the problem. And then it comes back to, well, how does democracy work in this situation? Right? Because we elect local politicians at state level and a federal level. Those politicians should be representing us and our interests. But in fact, many of them are actually contaminated by that top-down view, by the broader agenda through, you know, Treasury and everything else, right? So there's a real problem with the way that democracy works at the moment, insofar that these entities can dictate and determine our futures in an undemocratic sense. And how often do we discover things imposed, like health records, for example, and, you know, central bank digital currencies without appropriate consultation? That's the question I've got. So once again, they think they know the best. They determine what's good for us. And we, compliant, just say, okay, that's fine. We'll just carry on and keep working and it'll be fine. Well, maybe it won't be.
We're in a very precarious situation around the world, Martin. It's not just Australia, it's not just the UK, it's all the Western nations are facing this. I fully expected our government in Australia under Morrison-Frydenberg to go into a major deficit spend. Now that money had to go somewhere. Now they've got all this money that they can play with. And basically in the process, they've reduced the purchasing power of everybody's cash. They've also reduced the savings of people in the process as well. So the only thing that seems to be encouraged here is to go into ever more and more and more debt. The trouble is, as incomes are slipping away, it's getting harder and harder and harder to even take on a loan. So, or like you said, it's all going to the top. Our media could expose this. It's like watching theatre, live theatre, taking place. And the actors are our governments and our central banks and our corporations. And we at the bottom have to sit there and pay homage to all of this. But in the meantime, when somebody says, oh, my life's so tough, and somebody will come along and say, you're not working hard enough. You should be smarter. And think, well, I'd like to be smart like a central bank, because that's a smart way to work. Seems to be government is overreaching on its control more and more and more, coupled with banking, which is making us work harder and harder and harder, coupled with our health system, which is centrally controlled. That's a lot of power to put into one area. As far as, say, fixing the inflation is concerned, I think there's a plan. That's what I believe is happening. I think the banks have been irresponsible, but I think they are deliberate. It could be fixed, but you're right. We have to get to our politicians and change their thinking. We have to actually get to them and say, hey, listen, we voted for you and we need you to do our bidding, not to make the corporations super wealthy and the working and middle classes so poor that we're going to see homelessness eventually. This is what I see. You'd be seeing this where you are.
Yeah, unfortunately in the UK, the number of homeless people is rising and the number of people with significant pressures. You know, the pressures are real. The question is, do we just go through the same cycle as we've been in the last 20 years, the same spin cycle, and expect a different outcome? I think we need a different way of thinking about it. And that's what this is all been about, George. So I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much. As always, we spend some time down in the rabbit hole, and some people will find some of what we say challenging, confronting, maybe even dead wrong. But if in fact it helps people question a little bit more, then I think we've achieved our objective.
Keep up the good work.
We'll do it again, George. We'll do it again. There's plenty of room down the rabbit hole. See you later. Take care.
Bye, Martin.